Pilot wave theory. So the focus of this conference is the nature of the quantum state. There are different approaches to quantum mechanics, different theories. I'm going to be focusing on what I think is the best way of understanding the wave function in this particular theory. That's really the pilot wave theory of de Broglie and Bohm. I've called it de Broglie's pilot wave theory here because, well, partly de Broglie was the first to actually propose it, but more importantly, the way de Broglie did it, his motivations and exactly how he arrived at this theory will play some role in my argument. I'm afraid this is my second ever PowerPoint presentation. I don't know whether to look up there or look here. So let me start. So de Broglie's theory, where was this theory first presented? October 1927 at the 5th Solvay Conference. De Broglie presented what was a new form of dynamics for a many-body system. A non-relativistic many-body system. And he called it the pilot wave theory. And in this theory, the velocity of the system in configuration space is determined by a wave in that configuration space, which is none other than the usual Schrödinger wave function. Now, at this conference, three different theories of quantum mechanics were presented. There was Schrödinger's wave mechanics. He thought of the wave function as sort of like a physical field comparable to the electromagnetic field. Then Born and Heisenberg presented their what they called quantum mechanics, which was actually quite a bit different from what we think of as quantum mechanics. For instance, there's no collapse postulate. There's no time dependence in the quantum state. But that's another story. And then the third theory that was presented was de Broglie's pilot wave theory, and all three theories were extensively discussed. Now, there's a lot of mythology about this conference that you'll find in many, not only in textbooks, but in history books written by the most well-known historians. For instance, Mayer and Reckenberg have this multi-volume historical development of quantum theory. Without wanting to sound immodest, almost everything you've heard about what happened at this conference is completely wrong. It's usually thought that it was dominated by the Bohr-Einstein debate. It turns out that Bohr and Einstein, in the actual published proceedings, say very little. And that debate was a sort of private affair between the two of them over lunch and dinner. There's a claim, for instance, in Max Jammer's book that de Broglie's pilot wave theory was hardly discussed at all. In fact, it was extensively discussed. It's widely thought that he presented only the one-body pilot wave theory. It's not true. He had a many-body theory in configuration space. There's a claim that he was unable to reply to Pauli's objection, this famous objection about inelastic scattering. This was supposedly eventually sorted out by Bohm. It's actually not true. De Broglie's reply to Pauli was essentially correct. And in fact, Bohm misunderstood what Pauli's example was, or he misunderstood it, or perhaps never even really read it. Pauli gave a peculiar example in which it appeared as if you could never get separation of packets after a scattering. It's a long story. Those who want the full story are advised to buy this book, which is just coming out this October, finally being published. There is actually a complete draft online on QuantPH. But then you don't get the nice cover, where here you see the main protagonists. You have de Broglie, you have Schrödinger, and you have Born and Heisenberg. And we deliberately put Einstein and Bohr in the background because they're actually not so central. But let me move on. What was the theory that de Broglie actually proposed? This is the theory, these are the equations of de Broglie's theory in 1927, the standard Schrödinger equation for a many-body system of spinless particles. and the guidance equation. It's a deterministic theory. De Broglie outlines some elementary applications, interference, atomic orbits. There was some discussion of scattering at the conference. At that time, people didn't really talk about the quantum theory of measurement. People, or almost nobody, thought of applying the quantum formalism to the equipment. De Broglie later on, a year later, for reasons of his own, he abandoned this theory. He didn't fully understand how it was equivalent to quantum mechanics. That was sorted out by Bohm in 1952, where essentially he applied this dynamics. In certain situations, it's essential that you apply that dynamics to the apparatus as well as just the system. And it's important to note that you get quantum mechanics if you assume that the initial probability is equal to psi squared over an ensemble. It's an assumption that De Broglie made. It's an assumption that Bohm made. But it should be noted that Bohm's 1952 version is actually somewhat different. Bohm presented the dynamics in a Newtonian form, where the equation of motion is, instead of being this first-order equation for velocity that De Broglie had, it's a second-order equation for acceleration, with a quantum potential appearing generated by the wave function. In that theory, and Bohm is very explicit about this in his papers, you get quantum mechanics if you assume the initial p is psi squared and if you assume the initial momenta are given by the gradient of s. And for Bohm, both of these conditions are just initial conditions that you need to get quantum mechanics, but could in principle be relaxed. Even the momenta equal to grad s, Bohm pointed out in his papers, you could relax that. It's not really part of the fundamental theory. Whereas for De Broglie, this is actually the law of motion. So De Broglie's dynamics gives you quantum theory if you have p equals psi squared. Bohm's dynamics gives you quantum theory if you have this further condition. As I've emphasized a lot, De Broglie's dynamics, if it's true, and quantum theory is a restriction of a wider theory in which you have probabilities not equal to psi squared. In Bohm's dynamics, there's an even wider theory in which momenta are not equal to the gradient of s, which I've started to explore with Samuel Collin and Ward Stroyver. And just to be clear, what some people call Bohmian mechanics, this theory here, is actually De Broglie's dynamics. I think it helps to distinguish between De Broglie's dynamics and Bohm's dynamics. Now, this is just finishing a bit of background here. It seems to me, when it is a very peculiar history here, because the full theory, I mean, fundamentally, the theory is the dynamics. The rest is, okay, you assume some initial conditions, you work it through, you derive the phenomenology. Why it's taken us a long time, in a sense, to catch up with this, these equations that were written down in 1927. There's been a kind of process of catching up with this dynamics. It's as if those equations knew more than we did. De Broglie didn't fully understand them. Bohm eventually understood how you get the full quantum theory of measurement. Bohm also recognized the non-locality in this theory, the irreducible non-locality. Bell wondered if this was a general feature and found that it is. He proved that it's not just a peculiarity of this theory. Similarly with contextuality, another property of the theory is that if you have these non-equilibrium distributions, you get superluminal signaling of the statistical level. And something I've done and shown that this is true in any deterministic hidden variables theory. And in this sequence, most recently, Montina has shown that this fact that you have an exponentially large number of degrees of freedom, this physical field that appears in the dynamics, the wave function, is a rather general feature of deterministic hidden variables theories with some Markovian assumption. So that's just a bit of background, but now, so I think we're still, in a way, catching up with this theory. We're still trying to understand it. And it's not unusual in theoretical physics. One thinks, for instance, when Einstein published the general theory of relativity in 1915, almost a century later, people are still arguing over the meaning of diffeomorphism invariants, the meaning of observables in general relativity. It's not so odd that it might take a long time for us to understand what this theory is really about. So the question today is, well, in this theory, you have this psi, s is the phase of this psi. What is psi? How should we think about it? What is psi? Before saying how I think we should think about it, let me briefly critique what seem to me three unconvincing ways of thinking about it. First of all, Bohm in his 52 paper, he said something about, well, it's sort of, you can think of it as being a bit like the electromagnetic field. You've got various fields, there's the electromagnetic field, the gravitational field. Now we found this new field. I think that's a very poor comparison. Let me just say why. Because, among other reasons, there's no notion of test particle here. Field, you know, electromagnetic field, I can put an infinitesimal charge, I can probe the field, watch it accelerate. Here, if you introduce a test particle, it doesn't matter how small, insignificant, you increase the dimension of the configuration space on which this thing is defined. So it's a bit unfortunate that, we use the word field for things in space-time and field for things in configuration space. It would be perhaps better to have a different word. A similar point was made by de Broglie critiquing Schrödinger at the Fifth Solvay Conference. De Broglie said to Schrödinger, look, you say it's sort of like an electromagnetic wave, but look, the space in which it propagates depends on the number of degrees of freedom of the system. So it's very unlike standard fields. Another unconvincing idea, I think, an understandable but I think unconvincing idea is that the existence of only one universe somehow implies that the universal wave function cannot or should not be contingent. Because what would that mean, there's only one universe? I think that is something of a red herring. And here's why. So, for example, Goldstein's paper this year, the universal wave function is not controllable, it is what it is. But what about, say, the space-time geometry of the universe at the cosmological level? We currently think that it's almost flat, it's expanding, probably infinite. According to Einstein's field equations, it could have been curved, it could have been closed, it could have been hyperbolic. In our current physics, at least, it's a contingency. Even though there's only one universe, there's only one, you could say, you might say, I'll talk about that too. Similarly, the intergalactic magnetic field, there's just one field. But the precise form of both of these objects is a contingency in current physics. So I don't see why it should necessarily be any different for the universal wave function. And by the way, I'd like to say that I think we should beware of statements. Be careful when we say, well, look, there's only one universe. Clearly, it's true in a tautological sense, if you define the universe to be everything. But if we define the universe to be that which we know about, the observable universe, in other words, the subject of modern cosmology and its theories, well, actually, the current theories make it quite plausible that what we see is just one element of a huge and possibly infinite ensemble. For instance, the simplest model, what we see is just a tiny patch in an infinite expanding space. In eternal inflation, there is an infinity of pocket universes that keep popping up. There are multiverse theories. Some of these three theories range from the sort of fairly standard to the very controversial. But certainly, there's no particular reason in modern cosmology to think that what we're seeing is everything. So it could well be that we're looking at just one element of an ensemble. And furthermore, in this context, it's a little bit of a detour, but in this context, people worry about, well, what could it mean to talk about probability for the whole universe? We have to worry about this. Well, it turns out that practical practicing cosmologists, for instance, analyzing the microwave sky, are doing statistical analysis of this temperature. There's only one temperature pattern on the sky. And what they usually do is assume a kind of statistical rotational invariance that enables them to make a statistical analysis of the coefficients in a spherical harmonic expansion. I can talk about that in the questions if you like. But what I want to say, similarly with distribution of galaxies in the universe, this has been going on for decades. People are sending up satellites into space to analyze, to see whether this is Gaussian or not Gaussian, even though there's only one sky. In those discussions, they usually talk of a sort of theoretical ensemble of skies, and one can wonder what that is. And maybe we are part of one real ensemble. These are interesting issues, but I don't see that they have anything particularly to do with de Broglie-Bohm or with how to interpret the wave function of the universe as opposed to the microwave sky or anything else. Finally, another unconvincing, what I think is an unconvincing idea, this idea that psi is law-like. So this was idea was stressed first in a paper by Dürr, Goldstein, Zanghi, 1996. The quote, the fundamental wave function is static, stationary, and in the view of many physicists, unique. It's not true. Already in the early 90s, solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in loop quantum gravity had been found, and there you get the same kind of contingency that you get in solutions of the ordinary Schrodinger equation. There are an infinity of solutions. People are always in loop quantum cosmology. People are discussing cosmological models in this theory. For instance, there's recent work about collapsing universe where you get a bounce, but it's certainly not one solution. There are lots of cosmological models one could have that satisfy the same equations. Shelley said in his talk that, well, the more unique the solution is, the better it is for the nomological view. At the same time, the less unique it is, the worse it is, because it's a contingency. And it's not unique at all. It's, there are this infinity of solutions. So far, we did start a little bit late. Did we water is my clock fast? What time is it? Sorry? We started 5 minutes late, and what is the time now? Okay, good. Okay, so I've given a bit of background. I've said what I think it is the wrong way to look at it. What's the right way to look at it, according to me? So here's what I think it is. I think we have to get used to the idea that this is a new type of causal agent. That is, we're used to the idea of forces that cause acceleration. We're used to the idea of fields in empty space that accelerate charges. We tend not to appreciate just how hard it was for people to come up with those ideas and to get them accepted at the time. What I want to claim is that at least there's a natural view according to which the pilot wave is a next stage in this process. It's more abstract than forces and conventional fields, only in the sense that it's further removed from our everyday ideas. It just takes a further effort of abstraction for us to understand it, but it's nevertheless a real entity. And to convey this idea, I'm going to give a brief sort of recap, some history of causal agents in physics, beginning with the idea of forces that really came into their own in the 17th century with Newton, the idea of fields with Faraday and Maxwell, 19th century, and the peculiar thing about the pilot waves that were introduced in the 1920s by de Broglie is that even though he had this fully fledged theory, the concept went unrecognized, and my claim is that we should go back and recognize it. So first, forces. What is a force? The idea of a force, I think at least one way of looking at it is that, well, we have this everyday notion of pushing and pulling on things. And by a process of abstraction, you can imagine that, well, if I just have two bodies one of them can just push on the other. You know, there's no one actually there doing any pushing. It's just by a process of abstraction, we imagine that if this mass on the right is accelerating, then, well, there's a force acting on it that comes from this other body. And the mass times acceleration is the force. Forces cause acceleration of masses. Even across empty space, in as was believed for a couple of hundred years, instantaneously, in Newton's theory of gravity, which, you know, was the explanatory theory par excellence in physics for a couple of centuries. Two and a half centuries. The moon is attracted to the Earth. Nobody really smiles now if you teach that in high school. At the time, there were people ridiculing Newton. You know, what does it mean, the moon is attracted to the Earth? Is it sort of like I'm attracted to a woman? You know, well, what do you mean, attracted? The word attracted was thought to have a sort of animistic overtones, you know, the idea of the world as a kind of organism and sort of medieval ideas. I didn't have time to check this, preparing this talk. Going from memory, I think there's a famous letter by Leibniz ridiculing this idea, and Newton was incensed by this. And of course, in continental Europe, that was an era of a sort of emerging scientific enlightenment, and people thought, look, you know, forget all these mystical ideas, alchemy and so on. Things are caused by action by contact, Cartesian action by contact. In France, people thought, no, in this empty space, there has to be some medium. That, you know, and the Earth pushes the medium next to it, and things get pushed, and that's how somehow gravity works. Newton himself thought that. Newton never believed this. For him, this was a provisional theory. He tried to make theories with a deeper explanation in which you had an ethereal medium that causes gravity by action, by contact. He never managed to do it. It was a provisional theory. Even so, it turned out to be, for a long time, a very useful idea, which, you know, eventually became accepted, and of course has been overcome with general relativity. But in Newtonian gravity, there is this irreducible concept of a force at a distance. Next stage, fields. Michael Faraday, visionary experimental physicist with very limited mathematical skills, in the early 19th century, was looking at the phenomenon that you put iron filings near a bar magnet, they form this shape. So the magnet is obviously exerting some sort of force on the filings and making them assemble in this way. Faraday, he believed that if you took away the filings, there was still something there around the magnet. He called them lines of force. Now, these days, you think, well, of course, so what? At the time, think about this. If I have a massive body here that's accelerating, we say, well, there's a force acting on it. This is given by the mass times acceleration. If there's nothing there, there's no massive body, there's no charge body, there's nothing there, how can there be a force there? What are you talking about? You know, it's like having an adjective without a noun. I mean, there's nothing there. A force is something that acts on a massive body, makes it accelerate. There's no massive body accelerating, there's no force. But Faraday had this idea that, no, there are these lines of force, even in empty space, and they can move, and they have some reality. And people did think he was a bit of a crackpot. But he was such a good experimentalist, coming up with so many important things, you know, people had to recognize at least some of what he was doing. Eventually, this idea was put in mathematical form by Maxwell. Here's an electric field in an electrostatic case, electrostatic potential. Here is a traveling electromagnetic wave. Imagine what this, you know, you've got oscillating electric and magnetic fields moving through empty space. Imagine from a 17th century point of view, you have got nothing there. Then there's no mass, there's no charge, there's nothing. You've got waves of nothing. And yet we came to think of them as being real things because of the success, explanatory success of this theory. So what once seemed nonsense now seems very clear. Here's an electric field, there's empty space, you put one charge there, the charge is accelerated. Even where there are no charges, there is an electric field, we would say. These, if you like, inactive field elements. Here's an electric field, but there's no charge there. It exists, even though it's not doing anything, it's not pushing on anything, and they can propagate in empty space on their own. Now, question here is that all? I've brief thumbnail sketch it's been, of course, of the idea of force, the idea of fields, that we now just take so much for granted, we don't realize how strange, especially the idea of force at a distance, the idea of fields in empty space. But there's a question, these two types of causal agent, is that it? Is that going to be it for the rest of physics history? That we're not going to see any new kind of causal agent. Is it that there's just nothing else out there that we need, or is it that we've lost our imagination? Is it that actually, so my claim is that actually in the 1920s, de Broglie did propose, in effect, a new type of causal agent. He didn't fully understand it. For him, it was just a provisional theory, just like with Newton with his gravitation, just like, as many people viewed electrodynamics as a provisional theory, you need some medium behind it. De Broglie proposed the idea of pilot waves in configuration space, where a many-body system is guided by this velocity equation. Those who want to know the full history, again, I don't want to appear too much like I'm plugging my book, but there's a sort of 50, 60-page chapter all about what de Broglie actually did, how, let's see if I can summarize it in one slide. The idea of pilot waves, at the beginning in his thesis of 23-24, he proposed this velocity formula as a new law of motion, initially just for one particle. De Broglie's claim is that we have to abandon classical dynamics. One of his arguments was his brother in his private lab in his house in Paris, people used to do this sort of thing in those days in their own house in Paris, had experimented with one of many people experimenting with X-ray diffraction. De Broglie believed that X-rays were particle photons. He accepted that. A lot of people still didn't. How can they diffract? Imagine you have this X-ray photon, it's a particle, and it passes a sharp edge, and it diffracts, okay? Non-rectilinear motion. It hasn't touched the sharp edge. It hasn't hit it and bounced off. Non-rectilinear is moving in free space, but not uniformly in a straight line. According to de Broglie, that meant you have to abandon Newton's first law of motion and construct a new form of dynamics that involves particles and waves. And his guiding idea was that the variational principles of Maupertuis and Fermat have to somehow be unified, and his way of doing it was to, if you're familiar, Maupertuis variational principle, we have a line integral of the momentum, and the Fermat principle, we have a line integral of the gradient of the phase. For de Broglie, this law of motion encapsulated a way of unifying these two principles. You know, there's a lot of material here, but to cut a long story short, in 1920, de Broglie at the beginning was thinking in terms of relativistic phase waves. Schrödinger eventually found the correct wave equation for what at the time were known as de Broglie's waves. In an intervening period, there was a couple, two or three years where de Broglie was trying to derive this law of motion from a deeper theory. Okay? And now it's for a many-body system. And then, early in 1927, de Broglie, in a very crucial paper, at the end of the paper, he's struggling to try to derive this. And he says at the end, well, as a provisional theory, you could just postulate this equation with the Schrödinger wave function and leave it at that. And that's the pilot wave theory that he proposed at the Fifth Solvay Conference. Now, what kind of deeper theory did de Broglie have in mind? Well, very briefly, he had a theory in which there's a many particles. Each particle he imagined was represented by a free space wave or free space field that's singular. So a moving particle, you've got a field that is almost zero everywhere and at some point has a sharp singularity. And there are many of these moving. And these fields obey coupled partial differential equations. And de Broglie's hope was that if you could solve these equations, these coupled partial differential equations, the motion of these singularities would be such that the velocities are given by the gradient of the phase of the wave, of what we call the wave function. So the wave function for de Broglie was a kind of mathematical thing that, you know, fundamentally there are these coupled partial differential equations for these singularities. In principle, I solve them and I get certain motions, and it turns out that the velocities are given by the gradient of the phase of the Schrödinger wave function. That was what de Broglie hoped to show. He couldn't solve these coupled partial differential equations. So he just said, well, we could just propose as a provisional theory that forget this underlying picture of the singularities and the free space fields. We've just got point particles being guided by the pilot wave according to this formula, and let's leave it at that for now, and maybe later we'll come back and we'll try to do the deeper theory. Compare with what Newton did with gravity, compared with how people were thinking about electrodynamics. So this concept of pilot wave, I want to emphasize, arose again by a process of abstraction. It's not clear the extent to which de Broglie was conscious that I'm going to abstract this, and it's not clear the extent to which Newton was thinking like this, but in effect, this is what happened. You have this sort of scaffolding, if you like. You know, as in electromagnetic theory, you imagine there's a material medium, and then you get rid of the scaffolding, you say, look, I've just got an electromagnetic field, and it's a new concept. Here, something very similar happened, in effect, that you abstract away this underlying model, and you arrive at this new concept, which I claim we should try to recognize as a real physical causal agent in configuration space, as difficult as that may be to understand. So what is this thing called psi? Well, looking at this theory, it seems pretty clear that it exists in configuration space, even where there is no configuration. Empty branches of the wave function exist in this theory. They could come back and re-overlap with the part of the wave function that's carrying the system and affect the motion. You have to, in some sense, believe, I think, that configuration space is real, that the wave function on that space is real. And I would like to emphasize, there's an intriguing point here, that the way the theory was arrived at sort of fits in with its properties. I said it is obtained by abstracting away conventional free space interaction. 10 minutes? Great. You know, this idea in free space, I've got these singular fields and they're obeying coupled local partial differential equations. You abstract that away and you just say, no, the motion is not just effectively given by the gradient of this phase in configuration space. That is the cause of the motion. The resulting theory is, in a specific sense, this is something that was pointed out by Bohm much later, I think, perhaps from the 80s onwards, I think. But in any case, not back in 1952. That there's a sense in which this theory is non-mechanical. And the sense is this. Normally in physics, let's say, you know, say in Newtonian gravity, the force that the Earth exerts on the moon is a fixed function of the distance between them. So if this moves further away, the force diminishes, and it sort of makes sense to think, well, the force is coming from the Earth. It's a fixed function of the distance between the moon and the Earth. So it's sort of plausible that, well, the Earth is doing something, and it has a fixed law to it. Similarly, in electromagnetic theory, you know, you can formulate it as sort of, you know, the force on a charge here comes from a, you know, integrate over a Green's function over some current density over the past light cone. There is a fixed form for the for, for the the way these forces depend on distance and on velocity and so on. Here, if I have, let's just say I've got just two particles, let's just say do even in just one dimension. So the velocity of one particle is given by the gradient with respect to that particle of the phase of the wave function. This thing is not any kind of fixed function. This is the phase of the wave function, and it can be whatever. So there's a sense in which the there are no, I think as Bohm put it, there are no sort of pre-assigned interactions between particles. There are no fixed functions telling how the position of this affects the velocity of that. And so in a sense, it doesn't make real sense to say, well, you know, this particle is the origin of some sort of Aristotelian force. It's not that kind of theory. We should get away from thinking in terms of mechanics in this sense. And of course, this fits very nicely with the fact that, well, the way the theory was arrived at was precisely by abstracting away the idea that there was some underlying local three-space theory that gives rise to these motions. So following that line, I'd like to say that there's a sense in which, the configuration is a description of, you know, this three-dimensional world with its particles, its fields, and its curved space, and so on. But there's a sense in which the dynamics, and when I say a sense, I think there's probably, you know, more to be thought through here. I don't claim to have the ultimate way of looking at this, but I think that this is a direction we should be looking at. There's a sense in which the dynamics is grounded in configuration space. It's like to mention, for example, the origin of the velocity field. Some people argue that, well, you know, if you have non-relativistic particles, you justify the velocity field by some argument of space-time symmetries, Galilean invariants. I think that's the sort of wrong way to go, because just in one frame, there is a natural current, which one way of deriving it is this, some work with Ward-Stroeve last year. The field on configuration space obeys a Schrodinger equation. You can put that in a variational form with a sort of funny-looking Lagrangian density. That density has a global phase symmetry. This theory, if I change the global phase of the wave function on configuration space, it's invariant under that transformation. This Lagrangian density, you know, Noether's theorem tells us, well, then there will be a conserved current associated with that theory. It turns out that that current coincides with the de Broglie-Bohm current. And this is true for any Hamiltonian that's given by a differential operator. It could be, you know, it could include momenta to the power of 300 or something. It doesn't have to be just p squared, your usual sort of Hamiltonian. So I think it's sort of example. We should learn to think about this theory more in terms of configuration space. The other thing I think that is speaks in favor of thinking of configuration space as the real arena for this theory is that it provides such a natural account of non-locality in free space. So, you know, here is a box, two boxes. I have a pair of entangled particles. One in each box, and I've got many copies of this. If I do something at box B, say move the walls or switch on, change the local Hamiltonian, in this theory, that changing the local Hamiltonian, so these two boxes, I change the local Hamiltonian here, that induces a change, the wave function in configuration space starts to change in response to that. And instantaneously, the velocities of the particles in that box start to respond to what I did. And it's only when you're in quantum equilibrium that the effects over there cancel out. So you can imagine, for instance, I do something over there, and one particle starts moving this way, one particle starts moving the other way. The marginal distribution over there isn't affected. Okay, these particles, some move here, some move here. Overall, there's no change. But in quantum non-equilibrium, and this theory is in general a theory of non-equilibrium, equilibrium is just one particular state, like thermal equilibrium in classical physics. In non-equilibrium, you will see the marginal statistics at A will change. You will be able to send instantaneous signals at the statistical level. And there's something really amazing about this. I think much more amazing. People say, oh, this is faster than light. I think there's something else that is much more amazing than the fact that, never mind about the speed. What is really amazing about it is that this is independent of distance and of what's in between. This box A could be inside, you know, a huge concrete block buried under the ocean floor. The other box could be on the other side of the galaxy and inside, you know, a huge steel container 100 meters thick. The intervening space could be full of gas. Whatever it makes, according to our understanding, no difference whatsoever. Now, the idea, of course, in principle, you could say, well, there's just a force that is just goes through, and you can do that. The question here, what is the most convincing and natural explanation? It seems to me that the idea of this physical causal agent in configuration space is the idea that most convincingly explains this almost incredible thing. So let me, can I have two more minutes? It's okay? 2 more minutes. Good. Okay. So let me sort of recap a little bit and make a few comments. So this is the core of this talk has been this idea that the pilot waves are a sort of third kind of causal agent that unfortunately went unrecognized, but perhaps we should. And that is, you know, the forces, fields, and pilot waves have all arisen by, they're interesting parallels, by a process of abstraction from a sort of more concrete, if you like, idea. You abstract away the idea of pushing things, you get a force, you abstract away these iron filings. There's nothing there, but no, there are fields of force. Here you abstract away these mechanical or local interactions in these partial differential equations in free space, and you say that this function that is supposed to emerge and give you the motion is not just some effective thing, it is the causal agent. That's my proposal, but I want to put this in perspective. Okay, put this in perspective. That I don't think anyone is thinking that this is the ultimate theory. I don't know whether there's ever going to be an ultimate theory, and I certainly wouldn't expect this to be it. You know, we're scratching the surface of things. I think the more we dig, the more we're finding. Maybe there is an ultimate theory around the corner, but there's no need, when someone proposes a theory, there's no need to assume that he thinks it's the ultimate theory. Let's put this in context. What are the sort of likely, of course, we're guessing. I'm guessing here. Guessing what could be the status of this theory in the future? You know, Newtonian gravity was very useful for 250 years. Classical electrodynamics is still useful, even though we then quantized it. It could be, for instance, comparing this with Newtonian gravity, you might say, well, look, Newtonian gravity was eventually superseded by general relativity. Instead of waiting 250 years, let's do it now. Let's take this pilot wave theory and try to do something better. Maybe some really clever person will be able to do that. But it might be premature. It might be, you know, like someone in 1750 who's trying to develop general relativity. It might be that, look, to make progress, perhaps at least for a while, we have to accept this idea and develop its consequences. We might not be, Newton wasn't happy with action at a distance. We might not be happy with this idea, but perhaps developing it further, conceptually, looking for experimental consequences of non-equilibrium, this sort of thing, perhaps we will end up somewhere. We will make progress and things will become clearer later on. It might be that in that process, I mean, it seems to me there's sort of at least two things could happen. It could be that this pilot wave idea will will go the way Newtonian action at a distance did. It was sort of a useful idea for a while, but it's wrong. It's just wrong. There isn't this action at a distance, the Earth on the Moon. On the other hand, it could be that this pilot wave idea will be a bit more like the electromagnetic field. It's an indispensable new concept, which subsequently gets modified. I mean, here we are, 150 years later, we're still talking about the electromagnetic field. We quantized it, but it's still more or less that field, that concept has been important, is still important. Will the idea of pilot waves still be used, perhaps in some modified form in 100 years? I don't know. We'll see. But I think that for the moment, it is the most natural way to think about this theory that we have. So that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. That was very interesting. It was particularly interesting to hear after Shelley's talk. I just wanted to push you a little bit on the question of how different your viewpoint is from Shelley's. As a philosopher, when I hear you speak of a causal agent, when you hear Shelley talk about laws and the nomological view of psi. Well, I mean, I think of causation and laws as being in the same box.
Right.
And if I think about what the difference between them is, I think, well, causation is associated with the idea of the handles in the world that we can wield to wield something else.
Yeah.
Now, Shelley, if I remember rightly, was kind of, he mentioned the idea that we, you know, at least in the case of subsystems, we can control psi as a prima facie objection to the idea of thinking of it as a law, and kind of has a story about why, when you're looking at the subsystem case, it comes out like that.
Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is whether the main difference here is that you're focusing on, as it were, different aspects of the same thing, and that you're thinking of what Shelley is calling the subsystem case, where indeed you can use it. You can wiggle it to wiggle something else, whereas Shelley's thinking more of the universal case, where we're not thinking about wiggling things, and so it looks more as if it's on the law side of the nomological box rather than the causation side of the nomological box.
Yeah.
And how fair do you think that is, or is there some deeper difference that I'm missing?
Well, so what I think is that even in, I mean, I would say essentially the same thing for the universal case. And now the universal case, you know, I mean, let's not just talk about universe in the trivial sense of everything that exists. Let's talk about a sort of a realistic theory that has something to do with what we know. So a universal theory might be a sort of canonical quantum gravity for the whole universe sort of thing. Nelson talking about yesterday, and Shelley's mentioned. It could be, as Manali, I think, rightly pointed out, it could be that, well, it's actually something more like string theory or something where you have a time-dependent Schrodinger equation rather than. In either of those cases, I'm more inclined to take this view. And the reason, I think the essential problem for the nomological view is really the contingency. You know, if there was a natural theory in which, well, there's just one solution for this universal wave function, then I think Shelley's point of view would be an interesting thing to look at and explore, certainly. But there is no such theory. I mean, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that we have, as I said, has been solved and studied with the introduction of loop variables in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, there's an infinity of solutions. There are some issues about rigor, but there are issues about rigor in quantum field theory. It's true that you can say, in a sense, it's time independent. Okay, but even there, one worries about what time means. But even if that's true, I don't see that. Sure, the fact that it's time independent helps. I mean, as Shelley himself said, both are important. So, you know, if it's contingent, then to me, if the wave function of the universe is contingent, then it's like, you know, the intergalactic magnetic field is contingent. The space-time geometry of the universe is contingent. It could have been something else. And I think the fact that it could have been something else, to me, then it has that quality of, well, it's part of the stuff of the world.
Okay, so that I mean, there are people out there who will say, well, of course, we can imagine that the laws might have been something else. And indeed, in the context of various sort of multiverse approaches, they talk about the laws being different in different bubbles.
That's fair enough. I mean, those laws, it tends usually, these are sort of things like coupling constants and in particular, sure. But I mean, here we're talking about, I suppose the difference is that there's just, the contingency is so huge. It's not just that, well, I could have a different spontaneously broken vacuum state in which these particle masses are different and the strength of the electroweak interaction is different. I mean, you know, you can have one wave function on this superspace and you can have a completely different one. It is restricted by this one equation, but the contingency is infinite. It seems to me like too much of a stretch.
Yeah,
I understand your point.
That's very helpful. Yeah. It's given me a much clearer sense of where the difference
is. Yeah, that's
It seems that you're suggesting through this timeline. Through this timeline, it seems that you're suggesting that we are facing always the same situation in which there are some phenomena, and then through abstraction we come to some meaningful causal agent explanation. So why should we stop at 21st century? There is maybe another possibility to understand this timeline. It's not only a timeline of independent theories, but a development of coming from one level of theories to a more deeper, more fundamental theory. And it could be that in the quantum part of this timeline, we might really have to abandon causal agent explanation, and maybe that's just a possibility, have to adapt irreducible probabilities. But nevertheless, the previous points of that timeline could be understood as a kind of approximation of this more deeper fundamental theory. And it is indeed what we do work on, what we do work, like through decoherence or through some restricted measurements on the macroscopic level, we can derive in certain classical limits theories where effectively, as an approximation, you can introduce a causal agent. But it could be that this apparent realistic picture that we face on the macroscopic level is so deep that we now want to put it actually at the end of this road, at the quantum level.
Yeah.
So this just as a possible explanation.
Yeah. So maybe I just say a couple of things. First of all, perhaps I forgot to say this. One has to be careful with using history as a guide. I mean, this can only be suggestive. In fact, there's a sort of analogy I like to give. It's like, let's say, an experimenter in the lab. He's doing an experiment with a simple system. He's measuring something, and he plots two points on a graph. And then he draws a straight line through it. And he says, right, so, you know, I've found a law for... So it's a bit like that here. I've sort of got these two points on a graph. You know, this happened, and then it's for this much more complex system of the evolution of scientific law. So it's at best suggestive. It doesn't prove anything. I think it's a helpful way of conveying what I'm trying to say. But you're suggesting that, well, perhaps we ought to just give up the idea of causality altogether and have irreducible indeterminism. Well, there are various things to say about that. One is that, well, I find that it's as if we're giving up on the idea of explanation. If you could show that, well, you can't have such an explanation, well, then fine. Then I'll give up and I'll accept this. But given that there is a theory that is deterministic and that is actually quite straightforward, was written down in 1927, So I don't see any evidence for why we have to give up determinism. The only peculiarity here about that then comes into all this is that, as you may, you know, as I'm sure you would probably reply, is that, well, but, you know, you're saying it's all deterministic. Why can't we control it? Why can't we access these trajectories? Why can't we? And the reason, from my point of view, is that, well, we just happen to be stuck in this state of equilibrium. And in a way, it's sort of tough luck that we're. But the theory explains this. I mean, we know that every system that we have access to, every atom, every has a complex, long, violent history that traces back to the early universe. And by the sort of simulations that Samuel Colin was showing yesterday, I mean, if you believe this theory, you're going to expect that we're in equilibrium. But then it has to be admitted that, well, but then you're in a situation where, okay, you have an explanation for why we cannot see the details of these trajectories, but still, why should I believe them if I can never see the details? And I tend to agree with that. I think that this theory, if it's to be credible, if you take it seriously, you've got to be looking for non-equilibrium situations where you could see the underlying details in more detail, and in which the underlying determinism would be clearer to us. So at the moment, I think we're essentially in a situation where there are different ways of looking at this, and we don't know which is true. Sorry, that's a bit of a rambling answer, but.
This historical context may have just been suggestive, but I appreciate you putting it in this context.
Yes,
I
think it's helpful, yes.
My question is, as you are attempting to think in configuration space, what does the existence of fundamentally identical particles tell you? What inferences can you draw as you're thinking in configuration space of all these particles? Now you learn some of them are fundamentally identical. What lesson does one draw from that?
Yes. Well, so in the context of the non-relativistic theory, you know, some people like to work with a reduced configuration space in which sort of permutations of these particles are identified. Other people will say that, well, you have to put some constraint on the wave function. You know, symmetric, anti-symmetric in configuration space. I mean, in fact, my preferred way of looking at it is the following. Let's see if I can get this right. It's a while since I thought about this. But if you have, let's even just think in classical physics. If I have two particles that are identical, identical mass, identical charge, identical everything, if I swap them, the resulting trajectories have to be the same. Otherwise, I think it's true to say that you can, similarly in pilot wave theory, you can say, look, if I swap these positions, the trajectories have to be the same. And there is an argument which I sort of started and which I think was carried through by Guido Bacigalupi, but I'm not entirely sure how rigorous it was. But from this condition, perhaps with some other assumption, you can derive the symmetry or anti-symmetry of the wave function on configuration space, which you know, seems to me sort of quite a natural and nice way of looking at that.
Chris Timpson. So, Anthony, just a clarificatory question. In your fundamental picture of, in your picture of the fundamental arena of goings-on, physical goings-on, is it 3n plus three-dimensional, or is it just three-dimensional? That is, do you think there's a, in the fundamental ontology, there is the three space with particle positions in, then we have the 3n-dimensional space in which the wave function, the psi field, lives?
So, I wonder, you know, I suppose, so the way I tend to think about it, and I'm not sure, as I say, that this is perhaps the ultimate way to think about it, is that the actual configuration, so configuration space exists, this field on it exists, and the actual configuration Well, it contains within it, it is a description of this stuff here, which is not just particles, it's curved free space, it's fields. And I usually, when I look at it that way, I don't see that there's any real problem. I can identify, you know, I ask, what, you know, on what does our experience supervene? It supervenes on that actual configuration. Nevertheless, in a sense, you know, if that cup moves, we're moving in configuration space, and there's this way of guiding it. Usually, when I think about it, it seems to me very strange, very different from what we're used to, but unproblematic. But I do notice that, you know, quite frequently people, they think this is, you know, just crazy. So sometimes let's be honest here. I mean, we're all in the dark. We're all struggling, trying to understand these things. Sometimes I scratch my head and think, you know, what am I talking about? There's this empty packet in configuration space. But as I said, I said the way I tend to think about it. Perhaps even better answer would be, perhaps some of us should get our heads together and look at this theory and see, you know, what is the best way to look to interpret it. Maybe there's an answer that could be put in a better way than what I said.
I mean, I think it sounds as if you would agree with Albert's view of the marvelous point where you have the configuration space and then you have the point at which is instantiated, if you like.
I think that's probably essentially along those lines. Probably close anyway.
I'd like to make only a comment about psi nomological. If you have
psi
nomological.
Cosmological.
No, nomological.
Oh, nomological. Nomological. Yes.
So if you have a simple system like a ball in a gravitational field, the only thing we need are the dynamical laws, because you can control the system, you can impose our initial conditions the way we want. And that's the situation for almost all physical systems, except for the universe. The universe, you cannot control its initial conditions, not control the universe, you cannot do anything with the universe. So for cosmology, dynamical equations are not sufficient. We need some theory of initial conditions for doing cosmology. And one of the goals of quantum cosmology is also to arrive to this theory of initial conditions. That's why Hartle and Hawking proposed this boundary conditions with the aim to obtain a unique solution of the relativity equation. Well, we do not know what is this theory of initial conditions, but this is one of the goals of cosmology. And if sometime we arrive to a theory of initial conditions which singles out a unique solution of whatever quantum equation for the wave function of the universe it is, then psi nomological will make sense.
So I agree. I mean, I think I said that, you know, if there is sort of natural, it turns out there is this theory where there is just a unique solution, then the nomological picture becomes strong. I think it's the contingency that makes it weak. But if I could just add a couple of things, you know, you say, well, the universe we can't control. As I said, in these discussions often when we're talking about cosmology, people tend to think that somehow now it's very different from when we're just doing normal physics. I think that's overstated. I mean, for example, you know, in the 18th century, people couldn't control the solar system. You know, in fact, their knowledge of the solar system was probably, you know, not much better or maybe even worse than our knowledge of the universe now on intergalactic scales. And yet, you know, what do? You try to find out how things were in the past. I think I tend to be more, with respect to initial conditions, I'm more of an empiricist. It's an empirical question. How did the solar system form? It's an empirical question, where did the inhomogeneities in the microwave background form? How did galaxies form? And you know, the more we study the universe, the more we learn about what happened in the past. Now, you know, when you say we need a theory of initial conditions, I think if it was the case, let me put it this way, if we knew that the universe we're observing, this patch with its expansion and we've traced it back, if we knew that that was everything, let's say it starts at a singularity, there's some standard expansion, and it's a closed universe, and we knew that that was everything, then I think I would also be sitting there wondering, you know, the initial conditions, can they really be contingent? Do we need a theory of initial condition? Do we need to add some law-like constraint on initial condition? But we're not in that position at all. I mean, the Big Bang that we're observing in current theories, there's no particular reason to think that, you know, we are seeing everything. You know, I don't see that theoretical physics today is that much different from how it's been for a long time. That there are laws and there are initial and there are earlier conditions that empirically you try to find out about. But you know, having said that, if someone has a good theory where there's this unique, you know, universal wave function, then you know, that would be very interesting. And I think Shelley's view would be, I mean, it would be, I don't know, one might still wonder. I mean, I'd have to think about it a bit before I'd say I'd definitely commit myself. It certainly, obviously, would be a strong position.
Howard Weiser.
Yes.
Continuing, if I may, on this.
Yes.
This issue of nomological contingency.
Yeah.
But putting it now, drawing also on the historical framework which you put now, I'm sure some other people in the audience will remember this much better than I can, but after Newton's law was proposed, Newton's law of gravity.
Yes.
Someone proposed, this is great, and I can generalize it to explain everything by having a new functional, you know, a force which is a function of distance, which looks like 1 over r squared at long distances, but has some complicated shape, I don't know what it is, but, you know, at short distances, we'll explain molecules and whatever. So essentially they were saying, well, you know, the force law is now essentially arbitrary, but whatever it is, it's going to explain what's going on. Now, and that looks very much like a contingent sort of, you know, it seems like a lot of people were unhappy with that idea because it seemed so contingent. And as it turned out, it was wrong-headed. That in fact, forces turned out to be not that, you know, we can know what all the forces are, but they're much more constrained than that. So I guess all I'm suggesting is that maybe that's a historical example that shows that, you know, even if it may not be obvious at first, when you do have that, when we do have a new causal mechanism, that maybe there are severe constraints on, you know, how that may turn out to how the form that it may possibly have, and maybe this, yeah, and just a suggestion that the same thing could happen as people have been suggesting with in terms of the universal wave function.
Yeah, I mean, so sure. You know, I mean, look, the future of theoretical physics is impossible to predict, and you know, I think the interpretation of the objects in our theories will change depending on how our theories evolve. You know, what I've tried to sketch is what I think is the most natural interpretation, given the theory that we have. If someone wants to pursue a program, sort of like Shelley's, then fine, good luck, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, I mean, my critique of that has been more, is essentially saying, look, hang on a second, I mean, there were some people who suggested there's this unique wave function of the universe, but it's not, I mean, I think it's just sort of a bit gone out of the landscape now. I mean, for a couple of decades now, we have, you know, this infinity of solutions that people are exploring in great detail and giving different cosmological models, and, you know, it looks as contingent as anything else. And secondly, as I said, I think that this idea that, well, when we're talking about the whole universe, that now conceptually things are different. The whole universe can't be contingent. There's a problem with probability. I think those things are overstated. They are interesting and valid questions. But I don't see that currently in cosmology and the physics we have now, that if I'm thinking about, you know, how am I going to describe the inflation in the early universe, that I have to worry about that, because we don't know that this is everything. I think it's just being overstated. That's all I wanted to say. But anyway.
So we're going a bit over time, but probably can't refuse the question of one of the organizers.
Thanks. So it seems to me that you're talking about possibly revising the conceptual apparatus that we should use for our best physical theories. And a good methodological principle, I think, when you're contemplating that, is that you shouldn't abandon too many of the principles that seem to work well in previous theories. And I wonder whether maybe there's a disanalogy between the conceptual innovation you're proposing in the sort of the last step of your historical sequence and the first step. Because my impression is that one of the things about fields that compelled people to admit that they were real causal agents was the fact that you needed them to preserve conservation of energy. And furthermore, when you introduced fields into the ontology, you still had an action-reaction principle. Now, when you do the final step, the wave function doesn't obey an action-reaction principle, and that strikes me as an uncomfortable fact. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Let's see. So it's certainly not the case that, you know, principles that have been valid for a long time remain valid. Conservation of particle number or something. I mean, there are lots of examples where we've abandoned principles. It's true that this analogy, I'm sure there are lots of holes in these in this comparison. I don't quite know. I mean, perhaps your question is specifically, am I bothered by this action-reaction? Maybe that's the thing I should try to focus on. Action-reaction. So, you know, for a long time we thought that, well, there was an absolute space that in some sense acted on matter, generating the inertial motions, was not acted back upon. We're often told that this peculiarity is one of the motivations for general relativity, that, well, matter acts back on space, and so on. And because that was a successful theory, you know, then 90 years later, where we tend to be thinking, well, you know, that's what we should be doing. He succeeded, and we should, by thinking that, and we should keep thinking that, because it's probably going to succeed again. Well, you know, maybe, maybe not. I think what I would suggest, so specifically in reply to this, is that maybe that kind of thinking of action-reaction principle is a kind of standard mechanical kind of physics that we're used to. That, you know, A affects B, there must be a back reaction on A. Maybe, you know, this new concept is something that just doesn't respect that kind of idea. I mean, as simple as that. I mean, it could be that you're right, that there could be, I mean, it could be in a sense that we're both right, in the sense that, look, maybe we should take this as a starting point, but a further development of this theory would be to, well, try and build in some back reaction on this pilot wave. And maybe that will lead to something. I don't know. It could be that, you know, this theory is all just nonsense, and or it could be that actually this idea of back reaction on is just something that was fine for the sort of 3D based mechanistic physics that we had for centuries, and you're just carrying over, insisting on this sort of primitive based idea that here, look, we're more refined now, and we, you know, we don't, that's just an old-fashioned idea. Don't know. I mean, we don't know. But it's a fair point.
Okay, we should leave it here, I think. So let's thank Anthony again.
Thank you.